Chapter 17. And thus did the knights of the temple vanish with their secret, in whose shadow breathed a lofty yearning for the earthly city. But the abstract to which their efforts aspired lived on, unattainable, in unknown regions, and its inspiration, more than once in the course of time, has filled those spirits capable of receiving it. Victor Emile Michelet, Le Secret de la Chevalerie, 1932. He had a 1940s face. Judging by the old magazines I had found in the basement at home, everybody had a face like that in the 40s. It must have been wartime hunger that hollowed the cheeks and made the eyes vaguely feverish. This was a face I knew from photographs of firing squads, on both sides. In those days, men with the same face shot one another. Our visitor was wearing a blue suit, a white shirt, and a pearl-gray tie, and instinctively I asked myself why he was in civilian clothes. His hair, unnaturally black, was combed back from the temples in two bands, brilliantined, though with discretion, showing a bald, shiny crown traversed by fine strands, regular as telephone wires, that formed a centered V on his forehead. His face was tanned, marked not only by the explicitly colonial wrinkles. A pale scar ran across his left cheek from lip to ear, slicing imperceptibly through the left half of his black Adolphe Monjou mustache. The skin must have been opened less than a millimeter and stitched up. Menser? Or a grazing bullet's wound? He introduced himself, Colonel Ardenti, offering Belbo his hand and merely nodding at me when Belbo presented me as an assistant. He sat down, crossed his legs, drew up his trousers from the knee, revealing a pair of maroon socks, ankle length. "Colonel, on active service?" Belbo asked. Ardenti bared some high-quality dentures. "Retired, you could say. Or if you prefer, in the reserves. I may not look old, but I am."
"You don't look at all old," Belbo said.
"I've fought in 4 wars.
"You must have begun with Garibaldi."
"No, I was a volunteer lieutenant in Ethiopia, then a captain, again a volunteer in Spain, then a major back in Africa until we abandoned our colonies. Silver medal. In 43, well, let's just say I chose the losing side, and indeed I lost everything, save honor. I had the courage to start all over again in the ranks. Foreign Legion, School of Hard Knocks, Sergeant in 46, Colonel in 58 with Massu. Apparently I always choose the losing side. When de Gaulle's leftists took over, I retired and went to live in France. I had made some good friends in Algiers, so I set up an import-export firm in Marseille. This time I chose the winning side, apparently, since I now enjoy an independent income and can devote myself to my hobby. These past few years I've written down the results of my research. Here." From a leather briefcase he produced a voluminous file, which at the time seemed red to me. "So," Belbo said, "a book on the Templars."
"The Templars," the Colonel acknowledged. "A passion of mine almost from my youth. They, too, were soldiers of fortune who crossed the Mediterranean in search of glory."
"Signor Casaubon has also been studying the Templars," Belbo said. "He knows the subject better than I do. But tell us about your book."
"The Templars have always interested me, a handful of generous souls who bore the light of Europe among the savages of the two Tripolis."
"The Templars' adversaries weren't exactly savages," I remarked.
"Have you ever been captured by rebels in the Maghreb?" he asked me with heavy sarcasm.
"Not that I recall," I said. He glared at me, and I was glad I had never served in one of his platoons.
"Excuse me," he said, speaking to Belbo. "I belong to another generation."
He looked back at me defiantly.
"Is this some kind of trial, or—"
"We're here to talk about your work, Colonel," Belbo said. "Tell us about it, please."
"I want to make one thing clear immediately," the Colonel said, putting his hands on the file. "I am prepared to assume the production costs. You won't lose money on this. If you want scholarly references, I'll provide them. Just 2 hours ago, I met an expert in the field, a man who came here from Paris expressly to see me. He could contribute an authoritative preface." He anticipated Belbo's question and made a gesture. as if to say that for the moment it was best to leave the name unsaid, that it was a delicate matter. "Dr. Belbo," he said, "these pages contain all the elements of a story, a true story, and a most unusual story, better than any American thriller. I've discovered something, something very important, but it's only the beginning. I want to tell the world what I know, hoping that there may be somebody out there who can fit the rest of the puzzle together, somebody who might read the book and come forward. In other words, this is a fishing expedition of sorts, and time is of the essence. The one man who knew what I know now has probably been killed, precisely to keep him from divulging it. And if I can reach perhaps 2,000 readers with what I know, there will be no further point in doing away with me." He paused. "The two of you know something about the arrest of the Templars?" "Signor Casaubon told me about it recently, and I was struck by the fact that there was no resistance to the arrest, and the knights were caught by surprise." The colonel smiled condescendingly. "True, but it's absurd to think that men powerful enough to frighten the King of France would have been unable to find out that a few rogues were stirring up the king, and that the king was stirring up the pope. Quite absurd. Which suggests that there had to be a plan, a sublime plan. Suppose the Templars had a plan to conquer the world, and they knew the secret of an immense source of power, a secret whose preservation was worth the sacrifice of the whole Temple quarter in Paris, and of the commanderies scattered throughout the kingdom, also in Spain, Portugal, England, and Italy, the castles in the Holy Land, the monetary wealth, everything. Philip the Fair suspected this. Why else would he have unleashed a persecution that discredited the fair flower of French chivalry? The Temple realized that the king suspected and that he would attempt its destruction. Direct resistance was futile. The plan required time. Either the treasure, or whatever it was, had to be found, or it had to be exploited slowly. And the Temple's secret directorate, whose existence everyone now recognizes...
Everyone?
Of course. It's inconceivable that such a powerful order could have survived so long without having a secret directorate.
Your reasoning is flawless, Belbo said, giving me a sidelong glance.
The colonel went on. The Grand Master belonged to the secret directorate, but he must have served only as its cover to deceive outsiders. In La Chevalerie et les Aspects Secrets de l'Histoire, Gauthier Walter says that the Templar plan for world conquest was to be finally realized only in the year 2000. The Temple decided to go underground, and that meant that it had to look as if the Order were dead. They sacrificed themselves, that's what they did. The Grand Master included. Some let themselves be killed, they were probably chosen by lot. Others submitted, blending into the civilian landscape. What became of the minor officials, the lay brothers, the carpenters, the glaziers? That was how the Freemasons were born, later spreading throughout the world, as everyone knows. But in England, things happened differently. The king resisted the pope's pressure and pensioned the Templars off. They lived out their days meekly, in the order's great houses. Meekly, do you believe that? I don't. In Spain, the order changed its name to the Order of Montesa. Gentlemen, these were men who could bring a king to heel. They held so many of his promissory notes that they could have bankrupted him in a week. The King of Portugal, for instance, came to terms. Let us handle it like this, dear friends, he said. Don't call yourselves Knights of the Temple anymore. Change the name to Knights of Christ, and I'll be happy. In Germany, there were very few trials. The abolition of the order was purely formal, and in any case there was a brother order, the Teutonic Knights, who at the time were not merely a state within the state. They were the state, having acquired a territory as big as those countries now under the Russian heel, and they kept expanding until the end of the 15th century when the Mongols arrived. But that's another story, because the Mongols are at our gates even now. But I mustn't digress.
Yes, let us not digress, Belbo said.
Well then, as everyone knows, 2 days before Philip issued the arrest warrant, and a month before it was carried out, a hay wain drawn by oxen left the precincts of the temple for an unknown destination. Nostradamus himself alludes to it in one of his Centuries. He looked through his manuscript for the quotation.
Sous la pasture d'animaux ruminants, parurent conduits au ventre herbopolique, soldats cachés, les armes prises maintenant.
The Haywayne is a legend, I said, and I would hardly consider Nostradamus an authority in matters of historical fact.
People older than you, Signor Casaubon, have had faith in many of Nostradamus's prophecies. Not that I am so ingenuous as to take the story of the Haywayne literally. It's a symbol of the obvious established fact that Jacques de Molay, anticipating his arrest, turned over command of the order, as well as its secret instructions, to a nephew, Comte de Beaujeu, who became the head of the now clandestine temple.
Are there documents that bear this out?
Official history, the colonel said with a bitter smile, is written by the victors. According to official history, men like me don't exist. No, behind the story of the Haywayne lies something else. The temple's secret nucleus moved to a quiet spot, and from there they began to extend their underground network. This obvious fact was my starting point. For years, even before the war, I kept asking myself where these brothers in heroism might have gone. When I retired to private life, I finally decided to look for a trail. Since the flight of the Haywayne had occurred in France, France was where I should find the original gathering of the secret nucleus. But where in France?
He had a sense of theater. Belbo and I were all ears. We could find nothing better to say than, well, where?
I'll tell you. Where would the Templars have hidden? Where did Hugues de Pin come from? Champagne, near Troyes. And at the time the Templars were founded, Champagne was ruled by Hugues de Champagne, who joined them in Jerusalem just a few years later. When he came back, he apparently got in touch with the abbot of Citeaux and helped him initiate the study and translation of certain Hebrew texts in his monastery. Think about it. The White Benedictines, St. Bernard's Benedictines, also invited the rabbis of Upper Burgundy to come to Citeaux, to study whatever texts Hugues had found in Palestine. Hugues even gave St. Bernard's monks a forest at Bar-sur-Aube, where Clairvaux was later built. And what did St. Bernard do?
He became the champion of the Templars, I said.
But why? Did you know he made the Templars even more powerful than the Benedictines? That he prohibited the Benedictines from receiving gifts of lands and houses, and had them give lands and houses to the Templars instead? Have you ever seen the Forêt d'Orion near Troyes? It's immense, one commandery after the other. And in the meantime, you know, the knights in Palestine weren't fighting. They were settled in the temple, making friends with the Moslems instead of killing them. They communicated with Moslem mystics. In other words, St. Bernard, with the economic support of the Counts of Champagne, built an order in the Holy Land that was in contact with Arab and Jewish secret sects. An unknown directorate ran the Crusades in an effort to keep the order going, and not the other way around. And it set up a network of power that was outside royal jurisdiction. I am a man of action, not a man of science. Instead of spinning empty conjectures, I did what all the long-winded scholars have never done. I went to the place the Templars came from, the place that had been their base for 2 centuries, their home, where they could live like fish in water.
Chairman Mao says that revolutionaries must live among the people like fish in water, I said.
Good for your chairman. But the Templars were preparing a revolution far greater than the revolution of your pigtailed communists.
They don't wear pigtails anymore.
No? Well, so much the worse for them. As I was saying, the Templars must have sought refuge in Champagne. Pain, Troyes, the Eastern Forest. No, Pain was and still is a tiny village. At the time it had a castle at most. Troyes was a city, too many of the king's men around. The forest, which the Templars owned, was the first place the royal guards would look. Which they did, by the way. No, I said to myself, the only place that made sense was Provins.
Chapter 18. If our eye could penetrate the earth and see its interior from pole to pole, from where we stand to the Antipodes, we would glimpse with horror a mass terrifyingly riddled with fissures and caverns. Thomas Burnet, Tellurus Theoria Sacra, Amsterdam, Wolters, 1694, page 38.
Why Provins? Have you ever been to Provins? A magic place. You can feel it even today. Go there, a magic place, still redolent of secrets. In the 11th century it was the seat of the Comte de Champagne, a free zone where the central government couldn't come snooping. The Templars were at home there. Even today a street is named after them. There were churches, palaces, a castle overlooking the whole plain. And a lot of money, merchants doing business, fairs, confusion, where it was easy to pass unnoticed. But most important, something that has been there since prehistoric times. Tunnels. A network of tunnels, real catacombs, extends beneath the hill. Some tunnels are open to the public today. They were places where people could meet in secret, and if their enemies got in, the conspirators could disperse in a matter of seconds, disappearing into nowhere. And if they were really familiar with the passages, they could exit in one direction and reappear in the opposite, on padded feet, like cats. They could sneak up behind the intruders and cut them down in the dark. As God is my witness, gentlemen, those tunnels are tailor-made for commandos. Quick and invisible, you slip in at night, knife between your teeth, a couple of grenades in hand, and your enemies die like rats. His eyes were shining. Do you realize what a fabulous hiding place Provin must have been? A secret nucleus could meet underground, and the locals, even if they did see something, wouldn't say a word. The king's men, of course, did come to Provin. They arrested the Templars who were visible on the surface and took them to Paris. Reynaud de Provin was tortured but didn't talk. Clearly, the secret plan called for him to be arrested to make the king believe that Provin had been swept clean. But at the same time, he was to give a signal by refusing to talk. Provin would not yield. Not Provin, where the new underground Templars live on. Some tunnels lead from building to building. You can enter a granary or a warehouse and come out in a church. Some tunnels are constructed with columns and vaulted ceilings. Even today, every house in the upper city still has a cellar with ogival vaults. There must be more than 100 of them. And every cellar has an entrance to a tunnel. Conjecture, I said. No, young man. Fact. You haven't seen the tunnels of Provin. Room after room, deep in the earth, covered with ancient graffiti. The graffiti are found mostly in what speleologists call lateral cells. Hieratic drawings of druidic origin, scratched into the wall before the Romans came. Caesar passed overhead, while down below men plotted resistance, ambushes, spells. There are Catharist symbols, too. Yes, gentlemen, the Cathars in Provence were wiped out, but there were Cathars in Champagne also, and they survived, meeting secretly in these catacombs of heresy. 183 of them were burned above ground, but the others hid below. The chronicles call them Bougres or Manichéon. Now, mind you, the Bougres were simply Bogomils, Cathars of Bulgarian origin. Does the French word Bougre tell you anything? Originally it meant sodomite, because the Bulgarian Cathars were said to have that little failing. He gave a nervous laugh. And who else was accused of that same failing? The Templars. Curious, isn't it? Up to a point, I said. In those days, the easiest way to get rid of a heretic was to accuse him of sodomy. True, and you mustn't think that I believe the Templars actually... They were fighting men, and we fighting men like beautiful women. Vows or not, a man is a man. I mention this only because I don't believe it's a coincidence that Cathar heretics found refuge where the Templars were. But in any case, the Templars learned from them the use of caves and tunnels. But all this really is guesswork, Belbo said. It started with guesswork, yes. I'm just explaining why I set out to explore Provin. But now we come to the actual story. In the center of Provin is a big Gothic building, the Grand Jodim, or Tithe Granary. As you may know, one of the sources of the Templars' strength was that they collected tithes directly and didn't have to pay anything to the state. Under the building, as everywhere else, there's a network of passages, today in very bad condition. Well, as I was going through archives in Provin, I came across a local newspaper from 1894. In it was an article about two dragoons, Chevalier Camille Laforge of Tours and Chevalier Edward Ingolf of Petersburg, yes, Petersburg, who had visited the Grange a few days earlier. Accompanied by the caretaker, they went down into one of the subterranean rooms, on the second level below ground. When the caretaker, trying to show that there were other levels even farther down, stamped on the earth, they heard echoes and reverberations. The reporter praised the bold dragoons, who promptly fetched lanterns and ropes and went into the unknown tunnels like boys down a mine, pulling themselves forward on their elbows, crawling through mysterious passages. And the paper says they came to a great hall with a fine fireplace and a dry well in the center. They tied a stone to a rope, lowered it, and found that the well was 11 meters deep. They went back a week later with stronger ropes, and two companions lowered Ingolf into the well, where he discovered a big room with stone walls, 10 meters square and 5 meters high. The others then followed him down. They realized that they were at the third level, 30 meters beneath the surface. We don't know what the men saw and did in that room. The reporter admits that when he went to the scene to investigate, he lacked the courage to go down into the well. I was excited by the story and felt a desire to visit the place. But many of the tunnels had collapsed since the end of the last century, and even if such a well did exist at that time, there was no way of telling where it was now. It suddenly occurred to me that the dragoons might have found something down there. I had recently read a book about the secret of Rennes le Château, another story in which the Templars figure. A penniless and obscure parish priest was restoring an old church in a little village of some 200 souls. A stone in the choir floor was lifted, revealing a box said to contain some very old manuscripts.
Only manuscripts?
We don't know exactly what happened next, but in later years the priest became immensely rich, threw money around, led a life of dissipation, and was finally brought before an ecclesiastical court. What if something similar had happened to one of the dragoons? Or to both? Ingolf went down first. Let's say he found some precious object, small enough to be hidden in his tunic. He came back up and said nothing to his companions. Well, I am a stubborn man, otherwise I wouldn't have lived the life I have. The colonel ran his fingers over his scar, then raised his hands to his temples and brushed his hair toward his nape, making sure it was in place. I went to the central telephone office in Paris and checked the directories of the entire country, looking for a family named Ingolf. I found only one in Auxerre and wrote a letter introducing myself as an amateur archaeologist. 2 weeks later I received a reply from an elderly midwife, the daughter of the Ingolf I had read about. She was curious to know why I was interested in him. In fact, she asked, for God's sake, could I tell her anything? I realized there was a mystery here, so I hurried to Auxerre. Mademoiselle Ingolf lives in a little ivy-covered cottage, its wooden gate held shut by a string looped around a nail. An old maid, tidy, kind, and uneducated. She asked me right away what I knew about her father, and I told her only that one day he had gone down into a tunnel in Provence. I said I was writing a historical monograph on the region. She was dumbfounded. She had no idea her father had ever been to Provence. Yes, he had been a dragoon, but he resigned from the service in 1895, before she was born. He bought this cottage in Auxerre, and in 1898 he married a local girl with some money of her own. Mademoiselle Ingolf was 5 when her mother died in 1915. Her father disappeared in 1935. Literally disappeared. He left for Paris, which he regularly visited at least twice a year, but was never heard from again. The local gendarmerie telephoned Paris. The man had vanished into thin air, presumed dead. And so our mademoiselle, left alone with only a meager inheritance, had to go to work. Apparently she never found a husband, and judging by the way she sighed, thereby also hangs a tale, probably the only tale in her life, and it must have ended badly. "Monsieur Ardenti," she said, "I suffer constant anguish and remorse, having learned nothing of poor papa's fate, not even the sight of his grave, if indeed there is one." She was eager to talk about him, describing him as very gentle and calm, a methodical, cultured man who spent his days reading and writing in a little attic study. He puttered in the garden now and then, and exchanged a few words with the pharmacist, also dead now. From time to time he traveled to Paris, on business, he said, and always came home with packages of books. The study was full of them. She wanted to show them to me. We went upstairs. It was a clean and tidy little room, which Mademoiselle Ingolf dusted once a week. She could take flowers to her mother's grave, but all she could do for poor papa was this. She kept it just as he left it. She wished she had gone to school so she could read those books of his, but they were in languages like Old French, Latin, German, and even Russian. Papa had been born and spent his childhood in Russia. His father had been a French embassy official. There were about 100 volumes in the library, most of them, I was delighted to see, on the trial of the Templars. For example, he had Renoir's Monument historique relatif à la condamnation des chevaliers du Temple, published in 1813, a great rarity. There were many volumes on secret writing systems, a whole collection on cryptography, and some works on paleography and diplomatic history. As I was leafing through an old account ledger, I found an annotation that made me start. It concerned the sale of a case, with no further description and no mention of the buyer's name. Nor was any price given, but the date was 1895, and the entries immediately below were quite meticulous. This was the ledger of a judicious gentleman shrewdly managing his nest egg. There were some notes on the purchase of items from antiquarian booksellers in Paris. I was beginning to understand. In the crypt in Provins, Ingolf must have found a gold case studded with precious stones. Without a moment's thought, he slipped it into his tunic and went back up, not saying a word to the others. At home, he found a parchment in the case. That much seems obvious. He went to Paris and contacted a collector of antiques, probably some blood-sucking pawnbroker, but the sale of the case, even so, left Ingolf comfortably off, if not rich. Then he went further, left the service, retired to the country, and started buying books and studying the parchment. Perhaps he was something of a treasure hunter to start with, otherwise he wouldn't have been exploring tunnels in Provins. He was probably educated enough to believe that he would eventually be able to decipher the parchment on his own. So he worked calmly, unruffled, for more than 30 years, a true monomaniac. Did he ever tell anyone about his discoveries? Who knows? One way or another, by 1935 he must have felt either that he had made considerable progress, or that he had come to a dead end, because he then apparently decided to turn to someone, either to tell that person what he knew or to find out what he needed to know. And what he knew must have been so secret and awesome that the person he turned to did away with him. But let us return to his attic. I wanted to see whether Ingolf had left any clues, so I told the good mademoiselle that if I examined her father's books I might perhaps find some trace of the discovery he had made in Provins. If so, I would give him full credit in my essay. She was enthusiastic. Anything for poor Papa. She invited me to stay the whole afternoon and to come back the next morning if necessary. She brought me coffee, turned on the lights, and went back to her garden, leaving me in full charge. The room had smooth white walls, no cupboards, nooks or crannies where I could rummage, but I neglected nothing. I looked above, below, and inside the few pieces of furniture. I searched through an almost empty wardrobe containing a few suits filled with mothballs. I looked behind the 3 or 4 framed engravings of landscapes. I'll spare you the details, but take it from me, I did a thorough job. It's not enough, for instance, to feel the stuffing of a sofa. You have to stick needles in to make sure you don't miss any foreign object. The colonel's experience, I realized, was not limited to battlefields. That left the books. I made a list of the titles and checked for underlinings and notes in the margins, for any hint at all. After a long while, I clumsily picked up an old volume with a heavy binding. I dropped it, and a handwritten sheet of paper fell out. It was notebook paper, and the texture and ink suggested that it wasn't very old. It could have been written in the last years of Ingolf's life. I barely glanced at it, but suddenly noticed something written in the margin. Provins, 1894. Well, you can imagine my excitement, the wave of emotion that swept over me. I realized that Ingolf had taken the original parchment to Paris, and that this was a copy. I felt no compunction. Mademoiselle Ingolf had dusted those books for years and had never come across that paper, otherwise she would have told me. Very well, let her continue to be unaware of it. The world is made up of winners and losers. I had had my share of defeat. It was time now to grasp victory. I folded the paper and put it in my pocket. I bade Mademoiselle Ingolf goodbye, telling her that, though I had found nothing of interest, I would nevertheless mention her father if I wrote anything. "Bless you," she said. "A man of action, gentlemen, especially one burning with the passion that blazed within me, can't have scruples when dealing with a dismal woman already sentenced by fate." "No need to apologize," Belbo said. "You did it. Just tell us the rest." "Gentlemen, I will now show you this text. Forgive me for using a photocopy. It's not distrust. I don't want to subject the original to further wear." "But Ingolf's copy wasn't the original," I said. "The parchment was the original." Kasabin, when originals no longer exist, the last copy is the original.
But Ingolf may have made errors in transcription.
You don't know what he did,
whereas I know Ingolf's transcription is true because I see no way the truth could be otherwise.
Therefore, Ingolf's copy is the original. Do we agree on this point, or do we sit and split hairs?
No, Belbo said, I hate that. Let's see your original copy.
Chapter 19. After Beaujeu, the Order has never ceased to exist, not for a moment, and after Aumont we find an uninterrupted sequence of Grand Masters of the Order down to our own time, and if the name and seat of the true Grand Master and the true Seneschals who rule the Order and guide its sublime labors remain a mystery today, an impenetrable secret known only to the truly enlightened, it is because the hour of the Order has not struck, and the time is not ripe.
Manuscript of 1760, in G. A. Schiffmann. Die Entstehung der Rittergrade in der Freimaurerei um die Mitte des 18. Jahrhunderts. Leipzig, Zeckel, 1882, pages 178-190.
This was our first remote contact with the plan. I could easily be somewhere else now if I hadn't been in Belbo's office that day. I could be, who knows, selling sesame seeds in Samarkand, or editing a series of books in Braille, or heading the First National Bank of Franz Josef Land. Counterfactual conditionals are always true because the premise is false. But I was there that day, so now I am where I am.
The colonel handed us the page with a flourish. I still have it here among my papers, in a little plastic folder. Printed on that thermal paper, photocopies used in those days, it is more yellowed and faded now. Actually, there were two texts on the page. The first, densely written, took up half the space. The second was divided into fragments of verses. The first text was a kind of demoniacal litany, a parody of a Semitic language. Kuabris, Defrabax, Rexulon, Ukazal, Uxab, Urpifel, Takulbain, Habrak, Hakorowin, Makwafel, Tabrain, Hamkatowin, Rokasor, Himasor, Argabil, Kakwan, Dokrabax, Rysaz, Rizabrax, Dekequan, Oquaquil, Zaitabor, Quaxaope, Dugrak, Xylobran, Decida, Magisuan, Rytak, Huidal, Uskolda, Arabeum, Ziprius, Mikrim, Kosmai, Duquifas, Rokarbis.
Not exactly clear, Belbo remarked.
No, it isn't, the colonel agreed slyly. And I might have spent my life trying to make sense of it, if one day, almost by chance, I hadn't found a book about Tritamius in a bookstall and noticed one of his coded messages. Pemersil Oshurmi Delmusen Fafalin. I had uncovered a clue, and I pursued it relentlessly. I knew nothing at all about Tritamius, but in Paris I found an edition of his Steganographia, Hoc est ars para cultum scriptorum animi sui voluntatem absentibus aperiendi certa, published in Frankfurt in 1606. The art of using secret writing in order to bear your soul to distant persons. A fascinating man, this Tritamius. A Benedictine abbot of Spanheim, late 15th, early 16th centuries, a scholar who knew Hebrew and Chaldean, oriental languages like Tartar. He corresponded with theologians, Kabbalists, alchemists, most certainly with the great Cornelius Agrippa of Nettesheim, and perhaps with Paracelsus. Tritamius masked his revelations about secret writings behind magical smoke screens. For instance, he recommended sending coded messages like the one you're looking at now. The recipient was then supposed to call upon angels like Pemersiel, Padiel, Dorothiel, and so on to help him decipher the real message. But many of his examples are actually military dispatches, and his book, dedicated to Philip, Count Palatine, and Duke of Bavaria, represents one of the first serious studies of cryptography.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I said, but didn't you say that Tritamius lived at least 100 years after the manuscript we're talking about was written?
Tritamius was associated with the Sodalitas Celtica, that was concerned with philosophy, astrology, Pythagorean mathematics. You see the connection? The Templars were an order whose initiates were also inspired by the wisdom of the ancient Celts.
That has been widely demonstrated. Somehow Tritemius also learned the cryptographic systems used by the Templars.
Amazing, Belbo said. And the transcription of the secret message? What does it say?
All in good time, gentlemen. Tritemius presents 40 major and 10 minor cryptosystems. Here I was lucky. Either that, or the Templars of Provins simply didn't make any great effort, since they were sure nobody would ever crack their code. I tried the first of the 40 major systems and assumed that only the first letter of each word counted.
Belbo asked to see the page and glanced over it.
You still get nonsense.
Kudruz.
Naturally, the colonel said condescendingly. The Templars may not have made a great effort, but they weren't altogether lazy, either. This first sequence of letters is itself a coded message, and I wondered whether the second series of 10 minor coding systems might not give an answer. For this second series, you see, Tritemius used some wheels. Here is the wheel for the first system.
He took another photocopy from his file, drew his chair up to the desk, and, asking us to pay careful attention, touched the letters with his closed fountain pen.
It's the simplest possible system. Consider only the outer circle. To code something, you replace each letter of your original message with the letter that precedes it. For A, you write Z, for B, you write A, and so on. Child's play for a secret agent nowadays, but back then it was considered witchcraft. To decode, of course, you go in the opposite direction, replacing each letter of the coded message with the letter that follows it. I tried it, and I was lucky again. It worked the very first time. Here's what it says.
He recited,
Les 36 invisibles séparés en 6 bandes. That is, the 36 invisibles divided into 6 groups.
Which means what?
Well, apparently nothing at first glance. It's a kind of headline announcing the establishment of a group. It was written in secret language for ritualistic reasons. Our Templars, satisfied they were putting their message in an inviolable inner sanctum, were content to use their 14th century French. But let's look at the second text.
Allah, ellipsis, Saint-Jean, 36, P, charrette de fin, 6, ellipsis, entier avec CL, P, ellipsis, les blancs montiacs, R, ellipsis, S, ellipsis, chevalier des points pour la, ellipsis, J, period, NC, period, 6 fois 6 en 6 place, chacune fois 20 à, ellipsis, 120 à, ellipsis, Iceste et l'ordonnation, à donjon li premier, it li secundes juste Iseus qui, ellipsis, pan, it a refuge, it a Notre-Dame de l'autre part de Lio, it a l'hôtel des Poplicains, it a la pierre, 3 fois 6 avant la feste, ellipsis, la grande pute.
This is the decoded message? Belbo asked, disappointed and amused.
Obviously, the dots in Ingolf's transcription stand for words that were illegible. Perhaps the parchment was damaged in places. But I've made a final transcription and translation based on surmises that are, if I do say so myself, unassailable. I've restored the text to its ancient splendor, as the saying goes.
With a magician's gesture, he flipped over the photocopy and showed us his notes, printed in capitals. The Knight of St. John, 36 years post-Haywane. 6 messages intact with seal for the knights with the white cloaks. Templars. Relapsy of Provins for Vengeance, revenge. 6 times 6 in 6 places. Each time 20 years makes 120 years. This is the plan. The first go to the castle, Iterum. Again, after 120 years, the second join those of the bread. Again to the refuge, again to Our Lady beyond the river, again to the hostel of the Poplicans, again to the stone. 3 times 6, 666, before the feast of the great whore.
Clear as mud, Belbo said. Of course it still needs interpretation, but Ingolf surely must have done that, as I have. If you know the history of the order, it's less obscure than it seems.
A pause. He asked for a glass of water and went over the text with us again, word by word.
Now then, the night of St. John's Eve, 36 years after the Heywane, the Templars charged with keeping the order alive escaped capture in September 1307 in a Heywane. At that time, the year was calculated from Easter to Easter. So 1307 would end at what we would consider Easter of 1308. Count 36 years after Easter 1308, and you arrive at Easter 1344. The message was placed in the crypt inside a precious case as a seal, a kind of deed attesting to some event that took place there on St. John's Eve after the establishment of the secret order. In other words, on June 23, 1344.
Why 1344?
I believe that between 1307 and 1344, the secret order was reorganized in preparation for the project proclaimed in the parchment. They had to wait till the dust had settled, till links could be forged again among Templars in 5 or 6 countries. Now, if the Templars waited 36 years, not 35 or 37, clearly it was because the number 36 had mystical properties for them, as the coded message confirms. The sum of the digits of 36 is 9, and I don't have to remind you of the profound significance of this number.
Am I disturbing you?
It was Diotalevi who had slipped in behind us on padded feet like a Templar of Provence.
Right up your alley, Belbo said.
He introduced him to the colonel, who didn't seem particularly disturbed. On the contrary, he was happy to have a larger and keen audience. He continued his exegesis, Diotalevi salivating at those numerological delicacies. Pure gematria.
We come now to the seals. 6 things intact with seals. Ingolf had found a case enclosed with a seal. For whom was this case sealed? For the White Cloaks, for the Templars. Next comes an R, several missing letters, and an S. I read it as Relapsi. Why? Because, as we all know, Relapsi were confessed defendants who later retracted, and Relapsi played a crucial role in the trial of the Templars. The Templars of Provence bore their identity as Relapsi proudly. They were the ones who disassociated themselves from that wicked farce of a trial. So the message refers to the Knights of Provence, Relapsi, who are preparing... what? The few letters we have suggest vengeance, vengeance, revenge.
Revenge for what?
Gentlemen, the whole Templar mystique from the trial on was focused on the plan to avenge Jacques de Molay. I don't think much of the Masonic rite, a mere bourgeois caricature of Templar knighthood, but nevertheless it's a reflection, however pale, of Templar practices. And one of the degrees of Scottish masonry was Cadoche Knight, the Knight of Revenge.
All right, the Templars were preparing for revenge. What next?
How much time would it take to carry out the plan of revenge? In the coded message, there is mention of 6 knights appearing 6 times in 6 places. 36 divided into 6 groups. Then it says, each time 20. What follows is unclear, but in Ingolf's transcription it looks like an A for ah, or years. Every 20 years, I conclude. 6 times, or 120 years in all. Later on in the message, we find a list of 6 places, or 6 tasks, to be performed. There is mention of an ordination, a plan, project, or procedure to be followed. And it says the first group must go to a donjon or castle, while the second goes somewhere else, and so on down to the 6th. Then the document tells us that there should be another 6 documents, still sealed, scattered in different places. It is obvious to me that the seals are supposed to be opened in sequence at intervals of 120 years.
But what does 20 years each time mean? Diotalevi asked.
These knights of revenge are to carry out missions in particular places every 120 years. It's a kind of relay race. Clearly, 6 Templars set out on that night in 1344, each one going to one of the 6 places included in the plan. But the keeper of the first seal surely can't remain alive for 120 years. Instead, each keeper of each seal is to hold his post for 20 years and then pass the command on to a successor. 20 years seems a reasonable term. There would be 6 keepers per seal, each one serving 20 years. When the 120 years had gone by, the last keeper of the seal could read an instruction, for example, and then pass it on to the chief keeper of the second seal. That's why the verbs in the message are in the plural. The first Artigo here, the second there. Each location is, so to speak, under surveillance for 120 years by 6 knights who serve terms of 20 years each. If you add it up, you'll see that there are 5 spaces of 120 years between the first location and the sixth. 5 times 120 is 600. Add 600 to 1344, and you get 1944, which, by the way, is confirmed in the last line. Perfectly clear. Clear how? The last line says 3 times 6 before the feast of the great whore. This is another numerological gain, because the digits of 1944 add up to 18. 18 is 3 times 6. This further miraculous numerical coincidence suggested another very subtle enigma to the Templars. The year 1944 is the terminal date of the plan, but with a view to another target, the year 2000. The Templars believed that the second millennium would see the advent of their Jerusalem, an earthly Jerusalem, the anti-Jerusalem. They were persecuted as heretics, and in their hatred of the Church they came to identify with the Antichrist. They knew that throughout the occult tradition 666 was the number of the beast, and the 666th year was the year of the beast. Well, the 666th year after 1344 is the year 2000, when the Templars' revenge will triumph. The anti-Jerusalem is the new Babylon, and this is why 1944 is the year of the triumph of La Grande Poutre, the great whore of Babylon mentioned in the Apocalypse. The reference to 666 was a provocation, a bit of bravado from those fighting men. A gesture of defiance from outsiders, as they would be called today. Great story, don't you think? His eyes were moist as he looked at us, and so were his lips and mustache. He stroked his briefcase. All right, Belbo said. Let's assume that the message outlines the timing of a plan. But what plan? Now you're asking too much. If I knew that, I wouldn't need to cast this bait. But one thing I do know. Somewhere along the line, something went wrong, and the plan was not carried out. Otherwise, if I may say so, we'd know it. And I can understand the reason. 1944 wasn't an easy year. Back in 1344, the Templars had no way of predicting a disruptive world war. Excuse me for butting in, Diotalevi said. But if I understand correctly, when the first seal is opened, the succession of keepers of that seal doesn't end. It lives on until the breaking of the last seal, when all the representatives of the order are to be present. In every century, then, or strictly speaking, every 120 years, there would always be 6 keepers for each place, or 36 in all. Right, Ardenti said. 36 knights for each of the 6 places makes 216, the digits of which add up to 9. And since there are 6 centuries, we can multiply 216 by 6, which gives us 1,296, whose digits add up to 18, or 3 times 6, or 666. Diotalevi would perhaps have gone on to a numerological reconstruction of the history of the world if Belbo hadn't stopped him with one of those looks mothers give children when they are acting up. But the colonel immediately recognized Diotalevi as an enlightened mind. Splendid, Professor! It's a revelation! By the way, did you know that 9 was the number of the knights who founded the temple in Jerusalem? And the great name of God, as expressed in the Tetragrammaton, Diotalevi said, has 72 letters, and 7 plus 2 makes 9. But that's not all, if you'll allow me. The Pythagorean tradition, which Kabbalah preserves, or perhaps inspired, notes that the sum of the odd numbers from 1 to 7 is 16, and the sum of the even numbers from 2 to 8 is 20, and 20 plus 16 makes 36. My God, Professor! The colonel was beside himself. I knew it! I knew it! You've given me the courage to go on. Now I know that I'm close to the truth. Had Diotalevi turned arithmetic into a religion, or religion into arithmetic? Perhaps both. Or maybe he was just an atheist, flirting with the rapture of some superior heaven. He could have become a fanatic of roulette, and that would have been better. Instead, he thought of himself as an unbelieving rabbi. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but Belbo intervened and broke the spell with his Piedmont-style good sense. More lines of the message remained for the colonel to interpret, and we were all eager to hear.
It was now 6 o'clock. 6 p.m., I thought. 18 hours.
All right, Belbo said. 36 per century. Step by step, the knights prepare to converge on the stone.
But what is this stone?
Really, gentlemen, the stone is, of course, the Grail.